On Tech News Today, we'll tell you why Indian companies are dropping Zuckerberg's internet.org like a hot samosa. Plus, Snapchat is using its own app to steal employees from Uber. And the LA school district says Apple ripped them off, and now they want a refund. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, April 16th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. Get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code TNT when you check out. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. My name is Mike Elgin. Our co-anchor today is Chief Correspondent and Editor-at-Large of Mashable, Lance Yulinoff. How you doing, Lance?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. By the way, do you have the time?
Oh, wait. Let me, let me check. Oh, yeah. It's I guess it's close to a little after one. That would be Apple Watch time, you know.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I guess I just assumed that globally all the time would be set to Cupertino, but I guess
it's
not.
It's very special. Right. Apple time is a very special time.
It is very special, and you're excited about something, some truly big news, Star Wars Emoji.
Yeah.
This is going to change everything.
Oh, my gosh. You know, of course, it's only three emojis. It's the C-3PO, it's a new droid that they have, and a stormtrooper. So you actually, when you're creating your tweet, you just put those hashtags in, and you'll get the little emojis. I wish they'd done so much more. I wanted Darth Vader and all these others. But they're doing this to coincide with Star Wars Celebration that's kicking off in Anaheim. And, you know, from what I understand, they are going to drop a new trailer any minute now. So, you know, we're all kind of... I'm a crazy Star Wars fan, so I am ready for it. I'm ready to see it now.
They also, I believe I saw the what is supposed to be the authentic poster for the upcoming movie. But in fairness about the emoji, you know, if you actually put like 1,000 stormtrooper emoji, you have a proper army. Although I hope nobody does that to me. But
yeah, I wish you would just put the emoji and not the text in there. It would save some characters. It doesn't work that way. So it's okay, but it's Star Wars, so I'm happy.
Yep. All right, so let's jump right into the news. Lance, a growing number of Indian businesses are abandoning Mark Zuckerberg's internet.org initiative out of concern for its effect on net neutrality in that country. Saritha Rai is an independent journalist and columnist who wrote about this story for Forbes, and she joins us now from Bangalore, India. Welcome to you.
Hey, Mike. Nice to be here.
Glad you're here. Now, before we talk about recent events, can you briefly tell us what Facebook's internet.org program is all about?
So Facebook launched internet.org in 2013. It's a high-profile coalition that's aimed at improving internet access in emerging markets like India, where a lot of people cannot afford to get internet service. And so Facebook launched this initiative to offer select content and services for free.
Yes, and this is actually similar to a previous program that Facebook had, and that, in fact, Google still has, right? It's in various countries around the world, they had been offering just a simple program where they would subsidize the connectivity. Since then, Facebook has launched internet.org, which is a much bigger and broader and more sort of ambitious program to get more people on the internet. It's projecting, you know, .org suggests that this is a sort of a philanthropic effort, but in fact, it really does favor certain websites, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, in India, for instance, Facebook has a bunch of businesses signed on. Now, Facebook says that, you know, millions in developing countries like India are either too poor or just unwilling to pay for the internet that they're connected to, and that internet is far too expensive for most folks. But the fact is that there are just a lot of violations of net neutrality principles here, because it involves special treatment for some online traffic. So, for instance, when Facebook makes selective content available to those who cannot afford to pay, who makes the selection and on what basis?
So which companies in particular have pulled out? Who are the, are any names that we'd recognize in there?
Not outside of India, but there's a large travel website, a travel e-commerce site called ClearTrip. There's a large language news organization called News Hunt. There is a large Indian television company called NDTV. And India's largest publisher, the Times of India Group, is also threatening to pull out. So there are several large Indian names, very recognizable in India, but not really outside the country.
Now these are companies that have been publicly withdrawing from internet.org involvement. What is the Indian public's reaction to all this, Ben?
Well, actually, Mike, in the last few days, India's internet has been pretty agog over what is described as a blatant violation of net neutrality principles, or an attempt to violate net neutrality principles, because the Indian telecoms regulator has been asking for opinion from Indian users on whether it should allow telcos to charge differently for different uses of bandwidth. So, for instance, there is India's largest telecoms and internet provider called Airtel that has just launched an initiative, a platform called Airtel Zero, where they're encouraging businesses to come and pay for what they call Airtel Zero, which in turn will then be, given to users, provided to users for free. So India's largest e-commerce retailer, online retailer called Flipkart, which is currently valued at $11 billion has the backing of several large internet investors from around the globe, is one of the companies that was contemplating a sort of a collaboration with Airtel Zero, and which has just now pulled out because literally 600,000 people have written to the Indian telecom regulators saying that they object to any differential pricing. So net neutrality is a really big subject in India right now. And Facebook's internet.org is just one part of it.
So I'm kind of curious, what does this mean for Facebook's efforts outside of India? Because this seems like this could happen again, that these programs, which are intended to give developing nations access to the internet, because they have to be, kind of curated almost through organizations like Facebook, when they try and do this elsewhere, are they going to run into the same problem? Or is this something you think that's unique to India?
Oh, it isn't unique to India at all. In fact, net neutrality is a universal, debate that's going on, not just in India, but elsewhere as well. And the reason India is important, Mike, is because India has 100 million users, Facebook users, and that is the second largest user base after the United States. That is a significant market for Facebook, and Facebook really does want this market to sort of be a kind of a forerunner for a lot of other emerging markets. So a lot of the initiatives that Facebook tries and makes successful here, it can then roll out in a lot of other countries. So India, therefore, is a very key market for Facebook and Facebook's internet.org as well.
Saritha, it's nearly, I believe it's nearly 10:45 p.m. in Bangalore. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, I really appreciate you staying up late and talking to us here today. This has been very enlightening. I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Mike.
All right.
It's my pleasure.
You can find Saritha Rai on Twitter at Saritha Rai. It's spelled just like it sounds. Got a ton more news in just a minute, but first, let's talk about shaving. Let's talk about Harry's, our sponsor today. You know, Harry's makes super high-quality blades. This is the bottom line. Super high-quality blades at about half the price that you're used to paying. Razor blades are a racket, let's face it. And Harry's is breaking through that racket and offering really good value for their various razor sets. And I love these sets because they give you everything you need to shave. For example, they have the Truman set, which is $15, the Jimmy Chin shave set, which is $20, and the Winston set, which is $25. These are beautiful razors and razor blades, and they come with shaving cream and extra blades, everything you need to have an amazing shave. And again, they'll bring it right to your door free. Shipping is free, and Harry's guarantees your satisfaction. Is just really great stuff, and they have lots of other products you're going to want to browse, and you can do that by going to the website. It's harrys.com. Go to the site, check out all they have. You don't want to be shaving the old way, the expensive way with inferior products. You want great products at a reasonable price, and you're going to find that at Harry's. Just go to harrys.com and get $5 off your first purchase with the code TNT at checkout. That's harrys.com. Enter the code TNT at checkout, and we thank Harry's for their support of Tech News Today. Well, Snapchat has been trying to poach employees from Uber, and they're doing it with an unexpected tool, Snapchat itself. Kathleen Shaikowski is a social media reporter for Forbes and joins us now to talk about this. Welcome to you, Kathleen.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Now, how is Snapchat using its own app to poach Uber employees?
Well, Forbes got a fun tip yesterday that Snapchat has created geofilters that appear when you send a photo on Snapchat as an option, as an optional filter. And what the filter looks like is it shows cab cars with Snapchat ghosts in the cars looking sad and upset. And at the top of the filter, it says, "This place driving you mad." And we saw a handful of these filters that are visible to users when they send a snap and look for filters at Uber's headquarters in San Francisco. And so this is kind of a clever, playful way for that Snapchat has confirmed it's using as a recruitment tool.
So is Snapchat admitted to doing this?
Yes, the company did confirm that these filters were created by its recruitment team. And Snapchat also confirmed that the filters are available so far in a handful of locations.
Kathleen, it stands to reason that if Snapchat is doing this near Uber, they're probably doing it all over San Francisco and Silicon Valley, and who knows, maybe even globally, doesn't it? I mean, is this? Do we have any information about them possibly doing this to other companies?
We're definitely looking into if other companies have Snapchat-specific filters that are at their headquarters. We saw on Twitter some comments from a Pinterest engineer that he was seeing filters at Pinterest headquarters, and we're kind of looking into see kind of the scope of these filters and where they are. But it's definitely a very creative, original take on how to attract engineers in a setting where there's such intense competition for technical talent.
Like such a weird sort of like reach for Snapchat. It's like, oh, Uber is the place, you know, which does something completely different than us. Uber's the place where we're going to find the talent we need for our business. I mean, does that seem unusual to you? Is there usually that sort of going across the fence to find people you need?
I think, as you put it, going across the fence is a very common trend that we see in the Valley. And we spoke to a CEO of Soha Systems here in San Francisco who described the engineering talent pool as a closed system, where essentially you kind of have a set group of highly talented engineers, and every company is kind of looking at that pool and, you know, applying different perks to jobs to try to attract engineers to their company, high salaries, free lunches, free transportation, attractive pre-IPO stock options. So in a sense, it's not surprising that Snapchat is looking to alternative new ways to recruit engineers. And, you know, Snapchat is rumored to be raising funding at a $19 billion valuation. Uber was most recently valued at over $40 billion with its latest funding round. So these are both very attractive companies to work for and are likely considering and looking to recruit the same engineering talent.
you know, they're playing with fire there, because I can imagine Uber actually picking up Snapchat employees in one of the Uber cars every time they pick up one and saying, hey, you know, would you like to have a job interview? I'll drive you to Uber headquarters right now. I mean, you mentioned free transportation. Uber is in a uniquely good position to provide that sort of thing. Kathleen Chaikowski is at Forbes.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at K Chaikowski. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Well, Facebook is testing a feature that would bring back the old status concept, but in a new way. It's called the sidebar status, and the tests are taking place in Taiwan and Australia. Nat Guerin writes for The Next Web and joins us to talk about this. Welcome to you, Nat.
Hey, Mike.
Now, tell us about sidebar status. What does it look like and how does it work?
It actually looks a lot like WhatsApp, which makes sense considering Facebook's acquisition last year. If you scroll the Facebook Messenger app, you click the right sidebar, you'll see a status of which of your friends are online on mobile. And you'll also get a little icon. A green dot means they're online right now. And if they're not online, but they recently accessed Facebook on mobile, you'll see a time of how many minutes ago or how many hours ago they were online. So in the test, if you click that button, instead you'll see the sidebar status where users can write about what they're doing right now, essentially kind of like a status back in the early days of Facebook when you're saying, you know, Nat is on Twit with Mike right now, or Nat is working really hard today, or Nat is blogging, you know, just all sorts of different things. So I think they're just trying to bring the status feature back to kind of make status kind of relevant again. You know, it is kind of what was one of the more defining features of Facebook in the early days. So it's kind of interesting to see them bring that back and tie that into Messenger as well.
Yeah, it feels really old school. You know, I'm just wondering if, you know, who can see my status, because obviously people are always concerned about Facebook and privacy. So now if this is lit up and if you're not paying attention and you don't turn it off, does that mean everybody can see whether or not you're actually there?
I think for the time being, according to the testing, you can. It'll show up to your close friends with your close friends appearing first, which is the same algorithm that's happening right now for the Facebook app in terms of seeing which of your friends are online and available to chat. I think the idea is that you can set privacy settings to who can see your current status, and your status will refresh every 12 hours. So it will be as up to date as possible, and you can set your privacy settings to the types of people you want to know what you're up to or where you're at.
Now, of course, I remember these from the old AIM days. Do you have a sense of how prevalent or popular status update type of messaging, or, you know, sort of while I'm away kind of messages are on social networks and on messaging platforms?
Well, back in the 90s, AIM away messages were the thing. You know, like, I grew up in that instant messaging era in my teenage years, and I think everyone kind of just custom and, like, designed them, made them bold, italics, different colors, and all these different stickers and emojis that went with them. So I think a lot of people took so much time to personalize their away messages back in the day that maybe bringing it back will bring a sense of nostalgia for that target group of people who have grown out of AIM and into Facebook and this era. So, yeah, it's interesting to see what they're doing. And if this ever rolls out worldwide, we'll see if people actually pay attention to them. Like I said, this type of feature is available on WhatsApp right now. And from what I see in WhatsApp, I don't think a lot of people take advantage of that yet. So if Facebook decides to bring it back and remind people that they used to be able to do this, then perhaps it will start to resonate with them.
Nat Guerin's current status is that she's at thenextweb.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Nat Guerin. Nat is spelled with two T's, and Guerin is spelled G-A-R-U-N. Thank you so much for joining us today, Nat.
Thanks, Mike.
The Los Angeles Unified School District thinks Apple ripped them off, and now they want a refund. As we reported on a previous episode, the district spent $1.3 billion to outfit 650,000 students with iPads. Yeah, they're the second largest school district in the country. Those iPads came with educational software created by a company called Pearson, which the district says didn't work as advertised. The move is the latest in a series of disasters for LA School's iPad program. First, they forgot to buy keyboards, for starters, and didn't budget for it. And then the FBI later raided the district as part of an investigation into the program's bidding process, and that investigation continues. I think the first mistake they made, Lance Yulinoff, is getting iPads. I think iPads are horribly suited for public education.
Oh, I don't know. You know, they can access all their cloud-based content. Heck, they can access their Google cloud-based content because, you know, a lot of school districts actually use Google Docs for doing the work. And Pearson is a known name in education. I don't know. Sounds like they spent a lot of money and they didn't do their research. And I feel like maybe the finger pointing should really be at the district for making some bad choices and not necessarily at Apple's iPad. But, you know, I could be wrong. I've done a lot of work on the iPad. You can't get things done.
You certainly can't get things done. But the problem with them is you can't send them home with the kids because they'll get mugged. And these are valuable things. What you want to do, in my opinion, and again, this is just my personal opinion. I'm not an educator. But I think that Chromebooks are ideally suited. They cost $200. And if you're buying, you know, hundreds of thousands of them, the school district could probably get them for $100. And then the kids can either take them home and they won't get mugged because who's going to steal a cheap Chromebook? or they can leave them at home and then they go home with any device and access the same cloud-based documents. I just think that it's a big mistake personally to choose an iPad, generally speaking, for general public education over something like a Chromebook. But again, that's just me.
Well, I'm going to say, Mike, that I think Chromebooks are an excellent idea because they're more disposable. But with a lot of the work having to be done on the cloud, there are going to be limitations. And I think that if they were trying to do more intense stuff, the iPad will actually allow them to do that. You know, having local applications certainly can make a difference. But I think your point is really well taken, that you don't want to hand them something that they have to worry about breaking or having stolen.
And I think you might agree with me that it's either one of these options is better than PCs, simply because school districts don't necessarily have the resources to protect them from a security perspective, from a training perspective, and all the rest. It's probably much better to have something like an iPad or something like a Chromebook, where the training and the virus situation is far, far less consequential than it would be on a full-blown PC.
That's a story that should be written. The end of PC's reign in the education system.
Yeah, calling for it.
I agree with that 100%. I think that there's a big shift going on there, and it really does relate a lot to their ability to support, update, implement the right stuff. And security is just a huge issue that it's hard for them to stay ahead on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it has to be said that this is a very, very bad day for Pearson Software. Well, Apple likes to do everything itself. So I guess it's no surprise that they're buying two forests to use for packaging of Apple products. The forests, which are in Maine and North Carolina, will total around 36,000 acres and be managed sustainably by the Conservation Fund. This is actually being billed. This is another example, I guess, like Facebook's internet.org, where they do something self-serving but call it this big benefit to mankind. In this case, they're saying, oh, we're preserving these forests, we're preventing development on these forests, and yeah, we're going to be harvesting them for slick paper packaging and cardboard and stuff for Apple products. Man, eventually, it's just like there's no limit to the degree to which Apple will go to control every single aspect of its supply chain.
Well, how long is it before we are actually declaring Apple a country? I mean, now they have forests. I mean, they have the economy of a small country, right? We've already seen that with the, was it $750 billion or something like that, the valuation. I mean, I think that the forest makes sense. They need a capital, so Cupertino becomes the capital for the country, and I guess that makes Tim Cook the president of the country. It's really something. But when you're operating at the scale that they're operating at, and when you're delivering 74 million iPhones in a single quarter, this is probably a serious concern. It would be interesting to know how were they supplying the packaging up to this point. And when did they finally reach the breaking point? They said, we need our own supply chain down to the roots.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, if they were a country, they would not be a democracy. They would be something like, they would be an authoritarian dictatorship, I think would be the best characterization of Apple as a country. Well,
we're on opposite sides of Apple, Mike, you and I.
I mean, let's face it, they are not a democracy. I think we could agree on that. All right, well, in product update news, now you can find your lost Android phone on Google. No, I'm serious. Google has integrated Android phone finding into Google search. Just type a search for Find My Phone, and a map showing the location of your phone will appear. You don't even have to press the enter key. Unbelievable.
Well, wait. Am I happy about that?
I don't know.
Wait a minute. It's like, what else? I'm going to type in, where are my keys? I mean, if it finds them, I know that they are literally watching me all the time.
I'm going to type in, where's Lance's phone, and see if I get anything.
That's another.
Wouldn't
no,
be surprised. Well, Meerkat beat Twitter's Periscope to the most important live streaming feature yet, Android availability. Meerkat for Android is now in open beta. You need to request access, but everyone who does is granted that access, at least so far. I think they're hedging their bets here, or I guess they're protecting themselves, Lance Ulanoff, by having this invite program, because at some point they may want to shut it off.
Yeah, you know, Meerkat is scrambling. When Twitter Periscope arrived, and Twitter is, you know, Twitter is really pressing hard on Periscope with the sort of players, like the celebrities and tastemakers, to have them use it as opposed to Meerkat. Right now, there's some people who are still doing both, but you feel the tension in that. And I know that Meerkat got all this funding, and obviously the part of that has gone to hurry up the development of Android, but they can't go fast enough. You know, a lot of people are putting their money on Periscope surviving, even if Periscope isn't in every way the better platform. It's certainly the better designed platform visually, but I don't know. I like both of them for different reasons, but I have trouble believing that Meerkat's going to survive. Sorry, Meerkat.
Yeah. I hope it does, but it's very difficult to compete against Twitter when your platform pretty much depends on Twitter. Twitter doesn't like that. Well, Cyanogen announced that it will pre-install Microsoft apps on its Cyanogen Mod version of Android OS later this year. The apps include Microsoft Office, Bing, Skype, OneDrive, OneNote, and Outlook. Microsoft will create what Cyanogen is calling native integrations for the OS. Lance Ulanoff, why the heck would they need native integrations? Why wouldn't they just create Android or use the Android versions?
I would think that they want compatibility with the files created on other platforms. I just think this is seriously, when I first heard this show, I was like, Cyanogen? I mean, I barely know who they are. This is not going to make much of a difference. It's a forked Android platform. It seems more like a dig. And, you know, Microsoft's focus these days is sort of ubiquity. They don't care anymore. They want you to have access to their applications on whatever platform you choose. Obviously, now we have a really solid Office suite on the iPad. And you're going to see that time and time again. So when they see an opportunity, especially an opportunity for the optics of being ahead and being better integrated than their competitors, they're going to do it. I just don't think it makes much of a difference here.
Well, it's a boon for Cyanogen, which seems to always take one step back and then take one step forward. In the case of being one step back, OnePlus, of course, recently introduced their Oxygen OS, replacing Cyanogen on the OnePlus One phones. And here's a case where they're getting this these apps and lots of publicity as well. So I think that's a legitimizing effort for both companies, actually, to a certain extent. Okay, well, in big numbers news, 20. That's the percentage of search market share in the United States now owned by Microsoft's Bing search engine, according to new data from Comscore. Most of Microsoft's gains have come at the expense of Yahoo, not Google. Yahoo's market share has fallen from 20% in 2009 to 12.7% today, according to the report. Now, it's further complicated by the fact that Microsoft and Yahoo have a partnership that was signed in 2009 that results in either Yahoo or Bing search results, depending on what sort of search, what platform, and so on. But in related news, Microsoft and Yahoo updated that partnership, and that update was announced today. The new deal gives Yahoo more control over how search results appear while retaining the use of Bing for most searches, and this is being billed as a big boon for Yahoo. However, the stock of both companies is down today.
I mean, I don't think of Yahoo as a search company anymore. It's a destination company. It's been operating more as a portal, and it's got a lot of content and information, and that's their big focus. People are going to obviously go to Google for their search. Bing has done a really good job. I think that news about their amount of market share there is probably the most interesting thing to me. That's a place where Microsoft is doing their job and making a difference. You know, you see them maybe stagnating a little bit on the OS side, and it's just interesting to see them grow this way on Bing, because not a lot of people talk about Bing all the time, but then some people feel so strongly against Google that they use Bing all the time.
Yeah, and that's true. You know, and I personally think that to a certain extent, Marissa Mayer is a mixed bag as a CEO. I think on the one hand, she's probably been more successful than her predecessors. And she's, you know, it's not an easy job because Yahoo is such a strange company coming from such a strange place. But on the other hand, I think she's only had one job in her life besides Yahoo, and that was working at Google. And to a very large extent, she seems to want to recreate Google at Yahoo.com. And this, you know, sort of resuscitating search as and Yahoo's control over search, I think, is part of it. This deal, of course, happened before her, you know, she became CEO long before. And so, you know, I think to a certain extent, we're going to see additional moves like this that will cause a stepwise approach to Yahoo being more and more like Google in every possible way. I wouldn't be surprised if they had smart glasses and a self-driving car before long. So we'll
Wouldn't it be smarter if Marissa Mayer were trying to model Yahoo after Apple? I mean, if you want to go after a really successful company, it's not been a great year for Google this year. And obviously right now they're dealing with those EU problems. And, you know, it is a company that does obviously quite well, but not at the scale of Apple. So, you know, maybe looking to that as a model, but of course, Yahoo has never made a piece of hardware, so they probably have a hard time doing that. But I agree with you. I think I have very mixed feelings about Marissa Mayer, mostly because it's sometimes hard to see exactly how she's winning. Every once in a while, you'll see a great app come out from Yahoo, and you're impressed by it. You'll hear news like this, but then you kind of forget about them. They haven't done a great job of integrating Tumblr. We hear rumors about it, but that should have been something they leveraged much more quickly, not doing it. So this little deal, by the way, to me is all about leveraging eyeballs. It's all about sort of people having brand awareness. And I don't think it's necessarily as much as we think it is about search.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. Well, here's another big number for you. $1.8 billion. That's how many dollars Etsy is worth, according to its IPO share price of $16 per share. Etsy, if you're not familiar with them, is the world's largest online store for handmade stuff.
It's artisanal. Everybody's having a great time with artisanal, handcrafted.
Right.
You know, they even the bells they rang, like some of them were handcrafted bells. I think they were like, you know, just perfect right out of the Etsy catalog. But it's not, I mean, what was it, 260, how many millions did you say it was worth?
It's their total worth, I'm going to get the exact number here, is $1.8 billion.
Oh, okay. Well,
it's actually lower than I thought it would be. I mean, I would have thought that'd be at least $3-4 billion. They're pretty huge, actually, and growing fast. So I would think that their ultimate valuation should be higher than that, but that's just me. And speaking of the word artisanal made a hilarious debut in the trailer for Silicon Valley, where Ehrlich goes off on his coworkers / roommates by saying, "What kind of monster puts artisanal butter in the freezer?" Great line. love that show. And okay, so we have one more big number for you. It sounds like a small number, but it's actually a big number. 6. That's a percentage of Americans who plan to buy an Apple Watch because they want to be like Lance Ulanoff, according to a new Reuters Ipsos poll. Men are twice as likely as women to buy the watch, according to the poll. Now, that men are twice as likely to buy the watch actually sounds like not a lot of women buy the watch, but compared to other smartwatch platforms, half, if in fact, you know, I guess 1/3 of the sales of the Apple Watch are to women, that blows away all other smartwatches to date in terms of female purchasing of the watch. Most smartwatches have not done a good job getting female customers.
No, and we also don't have really good sales numbers for smartwatches. You know, when you talk to Samsung, it's often shipped. Motorola, it's often shipped. I mean, I know they said there were early reports, I think, with the Moto 360. Maybe it was sold out when they first, you know, when it first hit the market. I don't know how many units that was. I mean, we just haven't heard that much about it. And yeah, it would be a huge deal if they capture the women's market, because time and time again, I've talked to women who look at these smartwatches and they're like, "Well, that is not something I would wear. It's not attractive." Apple Watch has the benefit right now of multiple materials and two different sizes, 42 and 38 millimeter, and a lot of different band choices. That said, the shape doesn't change and the interface doesn't change. You can change the face of the watch. So It'll be interesting to see where the limit is as more women approach it and say, well, yeah, that's attractive, but I kind of want, I want a different shape, and they're not going to get that. Personally, you know, as a guy, I feel like this ends up being, you know, this is spot on for me. I'm actually really happy with this.
And it also has to be said that today, Ming-Chi Kuo of KGI, he's an analyst who's very good at predicting things, estimates that Apple may have already sold 2.3 million Apple Watches compared to Android, for example, in the full year of 2004, not the full year because the Android Wear didn't ship till mid-year, but in 2014, something like 700,000, I believe, Android Wear watches shipped. So Apple is already several times, if this is accurate, times bigger of a seller than pretty much all smartwatches combined. I think that would be fair to say, because Android Wear itself dwarfs other platforms. Pebble's done okay, but nothing like these kinds of numbers. I believe they've sold probably between 1 and 2 million. So anyway, very interesting estimate there.
You know, I'd like to know Apple's real numbers, but there is a sense, absolutely a sense, that this is the first breakout star of the smartwatch category. And I think, you know, we had that leaked memo, the Apple leaked memo, which talks a little bit about the success and a little bit about not being able to get them in stores through, you know, until May now, possibly later. And that the all indications are that this is, you know, maybe Apple did something right here.
Yeah, and it also has to be kept in mind that it doesn't exist yet. These are pre-orders. Only Apple could sell 2.3 million of anything that isn't actually on the market yet. So, yeah, you know, they did it with the iPad, and they're doing it again with the Apple Watch. Well, in news you can use, Apple. Speaking of big companies that make tons of money, Google launched today a free new Android app called Google Handwriting Input. The app supports printing and handwriting in 82 languages and supports even hand-drawn emoji. So apparently you hand-draw an emoji and it will create that emoji cartoon character on the fly. And I can't wait to try this. This looks really, really cool.
I have to brush up on my penmanship. Yes. I have the worst handwriting of anyone. How many times do you like have to sign like for your credit card and they ask you to do it on a digital screen? I mean, if I had like a gallery of those things, I mean, it would be the funniest and most embarrassing thing you've ever seen. So a lot of times when I see these things, like, oh, good, they've got handwriting. I'm going back in time to a place I don't want to be. The drawing part is kind of cool because I draw a little bit, but I don't want to handwrite anything.
Yeah, me neither. My signature looks like the EKG of somebody who just died. So anyways, one last heartbeat and deep. All right, well, in news you can lose, a Tokyo department store called Mitsukoshi is getting a humanoid robot at the information desk. The robot is Toshiba's Aiko Chihita, and if you're watching the video, this is going to creep you the F out. Mm-hmm. I guarantee it. And she is programmed to answer questions at the store, but only in Japanese. The robot has been demoed at trade shows, and one of her tricks is that she does Japanese sign language, which is pretty cool. But this is her first real job, only in Japan. I don't know why, but for some reason, Japan loves these hyper-realistic humanoid robots. That's a real person right there.
I was going to say, what are they doing? Engineer. That video was very weird because the woman on the left, at first I was like, oh, wait, she's actually working the
she's
computer.
She's typing.
This is incredible.
She's designing another robot.
No, it's Skynet. You know, the Japanese have this fascination with this particular, these sort of uncanny valley destroyer robots that I think they kind of misdirect people a little bit, because the reality is, you know, as usual, robotics, the best robotics are the robotics you can't see. They're in your car. They're in all these other places. There are some cool humanoid robots that look less like humans. They won't freak you out as much. And they probably do more, like the Honda Asimo and even the Pepper robot that's coming from SoftBank. So I look at this stuff and I go, I don't know. It's just, that's just the Japanese weirdness, where they like that strange stuff. And they, you know, that robot has been around in one form or another for probably 5 years.
Right, and they've been updating the software and things like that and trying to add capabilities. And this has got to be some kind of publicity stunt to a certain extent as well.
Yeah.
Although it'll be interesting. I'd love to go see it, actually, in Tokyo if I can get over there pretty soon. If I go anywhere near Japan, I'm going to go check this thing out. Well,
Make it a guest. Make it a guest for the next show.
Exactly. Great. She would have nothing to talk about except this department store. Well, and it will all be in Japanese anyway. So anyway, it'd still be worth it. I'd still do it. Well, we got some email from TNT fan John Barnett, who said the following. Good morning, TNT. Just a few thoughts on the Google versus the EU discussion. We talked about the EU's pressing charges against Google for antitrust around its shopping search results. Now, I don't think the EU represents the majority of the population in Europe in its view that search results need to be less Google-centric. What the EU is failing to grasp is that Google search is a free service and, as such, I believe should have the right to prioritize its own offerings above any others. This is kind of a controversial point of view that I don't necessarily agree with. Right. I believe that a few people on various Twitch shows have expressed this opinion, which is that whether or not Google does or does not prioritize itself above other competitors in search results, whatever, it should be able to do that. That's fair because it's free and they're doing it for the advertising and so on. I personally don't think that's good for Google, and I don't think that's good in general. I think that to a certain extent, a search engine should represent faithfully what is actually happening on the internet, and also to a certain degree personalization. What do you think, Lance?
Yeah, but also it promotes your monopoly. I mean, it's a way of building monopoly. If you have control, if you've got 60 or 70% of the search market and you are driving toward 90 or 100%, put your services at the top and you will do so. But that obviously is a monopolistic move. Now, I don't know whether or not they're really doing this. Google's always had like portions where they have, the ability to own. You could pay to have your search result appear at the top. That's not Google, but that's a service that Google offers. But prioritizing Google's own services would be a stupid move on Google's part because it's smart enough to know that it does have a dominant position in search in many places around the world. So it can't act like that. It can't act like a bully because it's going to get slapped. And if the U.S. sees something like that, it'll probably go after them, but most likely not as aggressively as the EU, which can be like a dog on a bone, and it won't stop for probably the next 5 years till it gets some sort of satisfactory result.
And it's a very difficult thing to nail down. We talked about some of that difficulty on yesterday's show, but another dimension that we didn't talk about is the fact that, you think, okay, search results. Yeah, they have an algorithm and you type in a word and you get a list of results. But that's not the case with these types of results, with airlines and with shopping and so on. You get differently formatted results, and Google will argue that they're trying to maximize the quality of the experience to the user regardless of the source of the content. So in many cases, they've been dissatisfied with the presentation of the content by some competitors, and so they've reduced their visibility because it doesn't fit in with the formatting. And guess what? Google's formatting is just right for Google search results. And so, there are all kinds of little details like that sort of make you wonder, well, okay, so should the EU rule that they shouldn't try to maximize the quality of the user experience? Is that the rule? Like, how do you get around this stuff? And again, there's a lot of nebulous details around search results that make it very, very difficult to regulate and to control from a slow-moving governmental body like the European Union's privacy and antitrust authorities.
I mean, they'll even, Google will look at search results from partners within. So maybe they're not trying to like bubble up their own searches, but maybe they're looking at, for example, all airlines. Well, if all airlines want to be part of this sort of smarter search result, they probably have to format their information in this way. Google will tell people out there how to format their information so it appears either higher in search or also in a way that can fit with these modules that they've created. But it's not Google's result. It's Google's presentation. Is that the same thing as pushing aside other people's search results? I don't know. I mean, that could hurt smaller players who can't afford to maybe reorganize themselves or their information so it suits the Google search results. So it can get, like I think, like you said, it's nuanced, it's complicated. I don't see a smoking gun here, from my perspective, but that the EU won't give up on it.
Yeah, absolutely true. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Adrian Gorgescu in Romania, who posted this picture on Google+. And it's a picture of him watching Tech News Today on a bus. There we are. I don't think he's driving.
I was going to say, he's not driving, is he?
Yeah, I don't want to be part of that insurance report. Anyway, there it is. How do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT. And please don't watch while driving. You can listen, but if you watch, there could be trouble. Well, Lance Yulinoff, you know, one of the great things about living in either San Francisco or New York City is that there are tons and tons and tons of really interesting tech shows. In your case, you live in New York City and you went to the 3D print show recently. Yeah. Can you tell us about just generally what sort of trends and what sort of things that you saw there?
Well, you know, here's what I think about 3D printing. It's always very exciting. You get to talk about printing ears and printing arms. But there's a sort of more interesting real world, you might even call it mundane side, but it's where it's going to have the biggest impact. Printing stuff that's around your home, printing not just things that go on the wall and utility devices you can use here and there, printing actual furniture. The best moment, I think, of my visit last night was getting close to what has to be the world's biggest commercial 3D printer. And it is big. It was like almost 5 feet tall. So you're printing furniture within this thing. I think that is very exciting because that's what's going to happen in our world. We're going to start seeing people printing not just little tchotchkes, not just little Yodas and other silly stuff to put around the house, but stuff they can use. They're also going to have a 3D printed fashion show. And I went to this last year and I saw some of the fashions last night. And it's always a mix. Some stuff you're like, oh, elegant. That actually looks like it could be an outfit. And some of it looks absolutely ridiculous. It's kind of like, yeah, because they can. So some of that happens. You're like, please, please don't do that. But a lot of great printers. I saw like a $349 printer with cartridge-based PLA, which means you don't have to feed it through. So, you know, prices coming down, more availability, another company that's going to give you the ability to have subscription access to designs that you can just, you know, keep printing out. It's all, you know, it's all kind of coming to consumers, coming to real people's hands. We're going to be able to do real stuff with 3D printing. So it was a lot of fun.
And, of course, Lance will be writing about 3D printing, and you can follow him on Twitter at Lance Yulinoff, and he will no doubt link to those articles that he writes. Lance, thank you so much for co-anchoring today. I really appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Excellent. Thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun. Thanks,
great.
Everybody.
So did I. Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, you can subscribe on your favorite podcast app to Tech News Today, or you can choose another way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. If you'd like to help us grow our audience, here's how you can do it. Just post a link to Tech News Today, that's twit.tv/TNT, on the social media site of your choice, and tag three friends that you think might enjoy the show, along with your recommendation to subscribe. And we'd appreciate that. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv, or on the app or browser plugin of your choice. If you're ever north of San Francisco, come on into the Brick House and watch us as part of our live studio audience. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can follow me on Tumblr at mikeelgin.tumblr.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to tnt@twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that is the Tech News Today. This show was produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.